From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is
War News Radio.
I'm Jillian Ma.
And I'm Lewis Katz.
This week on War News Radio, Learning Experience, we hear about the training of Afghan soldiers.
Then, we speak with an Afghan journalist who studied at Swarthmore College.
Finally, we take a look at the role of foreign correspondents in today's media.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been accused of operating two secret prisons in Baghdad under a special unit of 3,000 Iraqi security forces. Watchdog group Human Rights Watch states that elite security forces in the 56th Brigade moved about 280 detainees from one military base to another ahead of an inspection last fall. The 56th Brigade reports directly to the Prime Minister's office and not to the Defense Ministry, as most security forces do. Individuals held at the facilities were subject to torture, including asphyxiation, beatings, and electric shocks, and held without trial or access to legal counsel. Government officials deny the allegations and claim the prisons, shut down under pressure last spring, were run by the Justice Ministry.
In a new report, the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee said that American diplomats and other mission employees in Iraq may be vulnerable when the U.S. military leaves at the end of the year. The committee questioned the ability of the Iraqi government to maintain stability without an American military presence. The study suggested preserving several hundred soldiers as guards of the American embassy. However, Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki is not expected to agree to anything less than a full withdrawal of U.S. forces.
An ongoing investigation into Afghanistan's Kabul Bank and the activity leading up to its near collapse in September has revealed massive fraud and corruption. Investigators say the bank was able to avoid close inspection by giving secret loans, bribes, and other financial payoffs to senior government officials. Kabul Bank is Afghanistan's largest bank and holds most of the government's accounts. In addition, the bank handles salary payments to almost 250,000 Afghan soldiers, police, and teachers. The investigation has serious consequences. Problems with regulation of the banking sector have caused the IMF to delay renewing its assistance program with Afghanistan. While Afghanistan relies on donor money to finance more than half of its annual budget, donor nations have been forced to hold off giving aid since recipients are required to be in good standing with the IMF.
Afghanistan has agreed to United Nations' plan to eliminate the use of child soldiers in its military. Afghan officials admit that the coalition efforts to dramatically bolster Afghan security forces have resulted in increased recruiting young boys into the police and army. The new agreement calls for heightened scrutiny of registration papers, which are often falsified for underage recruits. The plan also cracks down on the use of young boys as prostitutes, a cultural practice common in parts of the country.
According to a new report released from the Afghanistan Rights Monitor, the number of civilian deaths in the country hit a record high last year. In 2010, at least 2,421 Afghan civilians were killed, meaning almost 7 civilians were killed on an average day. The report finds that insurgents are responsible for about 60% of civilian deaths, while international forces are responsible for 20%, and Afghan forces are responsible for 12%.
9 people were killed this week in a suicide bombing at a Kabul supermarket. The Taliban have claimed responsibility for the bombing, in which 17 people were also injured. The attack targeted the head of Z Services, the U.S. security contractor formerly known as Blackwater. Finest Supermarket, located next to the British Embassy and near offices of the World Bank, is frequented by residents as well as Western security contractors and business people. A Z spokesman has said that no company employees were killed or injured in the attack.
Mass protests calling for the resignation of Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak have rocked Cairo for over a week. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators have assembled in Tahrir Square, chanting slogans and waving posters. Violence escalated dramatically when Mubarak loyalists violently clashed with the pro-democracy protesters. War News Radio checked in with two prominent Egyptians involved in the demonstrations, Khalid Fahmy and Hussam Bagat, for an update on the Tahrir Square protests. Khalid Fahmy is the chair of the History Department at the American University in Cairo.
Definitely people are afraid. They're afraid because of the
the very violent measures that the government has taken yesterday in order to disband the demonstrations.
Fahmy described the Mubarak supporters as thugs who were coordinated by government officials to intimidate the protesters.
I also saw with my own eyes people being directed from the streets. I witnessed this for about 3 hours. I wanted to know who these people were, where they were coming from. They appeared to be very agitated, very aggressive. They were carrying banners that were obviously handed down to them. These are people who were then put on trucks or semi-trucks and moved from one location to another and then finally released or unleashed onto the demonstrators. So there are various signs to indicate that these were not spontaneous groups of citizens supporting the president, as the state-controlled media is saying, but these were people who had been marshaled and controlled and organized by some agency in the government, and most probably it is the National Democratic Party.
According to Hassan Bagat, a human rights advocate and founder of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, thugs attacked the protesters with machetes, knives, sticks, and even Molotov cocktails.
They were nowhere to be seen for 8 days. They suddenly appeared together, and they start throwing rocks together both at the same time, and then they shift to Molotov cocktails. And then suddenly they appear as snipers, armed, and on top of buildings in a country where really people are not armed. It's clear that these are not genuine loyalists who are just expressing their views.
Fahmy says the spike in violence and prolonged standstill between the protesters and the government is taking a toll on the demonstrators.
The citizens of Cairo are obviously tired of this standoff. The normal life has basically come to a standstill. People want some kind of return to normality, and the longer this continues, the more polarized society in Cairo in particular, but in Egypt at large, will become.
As of the deadline for this program, protesters were planning a final push to oust Mubarak from power. Bagat is confident Mubarak will step down soon.
It is impossible for me to imagine him remaining in power after what he did yesterday. He just ruined his last chance, which was not a very big chance anyway, given his record for the last 30 years.
The United States has also called for an immediate transition of power, but Mubarak maintains that stepping down now will cause too much turmoil. He plans to remain in power, but will not seek re-election once his term ends in September.
This is War News Radio. After the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, the military established by the Taliban was dissolved, leaving security in the hands of NATO forces. 9 years later, war-fatigued electorates in America and elsewhere have been clamoring for the withdrawal of troops and resources from Afghanistan. Amandine Lee brings us more on the U.S. military's attempts to transition the security burden to the fledgling Afghan National Army.
In March 2009, when President Obama presented his strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he confirmed the surge of 17,000 additional American troops to the region. Just as importantly, he put forth his plans for Afghanistan's own military forces.
We will shift the emphasis of our mission to training and increasing the size of Afghan security forces so that they can eventually take the lead in securing their country. That's how we will prepare Afghans to take responsibility for their security and how we will ultimately be able to bring our own troops home.
The U.S. faces twin issues in Afghanistan, securing the land against insurgents and moving the country towards self-sufficiency so that American forces can leave. Obama's strategy strives to reconcile these issues by relying more on Afghanistan's military. But this entails a variety of new headaches. In 2009, Obama promised 4,000 troops dedicated to training Afghan soldiers. Lieutenant Colonel George Gatling of the U.S. Army is one man on the job, operating just outside of Kabul.
I am the OIC of an 18-man training mentor team. We came over, and our mission was to train and mentor the an an Afghan battalion, which is approximately 700, 800 soldiers.
Alongside classes on how to identify IEDs, set up a checkpoint, and read maps, Afghan soldiers must also learn how to function as a group. Gatling says one of the biggest tasks for his program is to get Afghan officers to show concern for their subordinates.
The officers will not be where the enlisted soldiers are receiving the training. They will be somewhere else, and we've taught them that if you are the platoon leader or if you are the company commander, your place of duty, you should be where your soldiers are. So you can start to learn who your soldiers are, how they act, how they operate, and the soldiers will get familiar with you.
Stephen Biddle, Roger Hertog Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, says that this is part of a program that the U.S. undertakes every time they try to build up a foreign military organization, instilling Western military values.
In Western military culture, and for the United States in particular, there's a very strong ethic that says that the soldier's interest should be put before and above the officer's interest. So, for example, at mealtime on an American military post, the enlisted, or out in the field, more importantly, the enlisted eat first, the officers eat second. There are many parts of the Afghan army where officers believe that they are by right due privileges that the enlisted are not, and are prepared to exploit enlisted soldiers for their own benefit by redirecting pay, for example.
Exploitative officers are just one dysfunction U.S. troops deal with when training Afghan soldiers. There are also language barriers, ethnic tensions between groups, and, Gatling says, incredibly low literacy rates among the recruits.
The vast majority of the soldiers that are coming in right now cannot, unfortunately, read or write. But the Afghan National Army has a literacy program.
In addition, drug use is prevalent everywhere in Afghanistan. Time magazine reports that a quarter of all troops use hashish or opium, though Gatling says it hasn't been an issue so far.
I've been here for 5 months, and we have never had any issues or incidents with any of the soldiers because they were chewing that or using that. And it's not that prevalent.
So why exactly is the U.S. investing so much money and effort in training a military organization that is not their own? Well, a lot of effective troops need to be on the ground, policing the populace and rooting out insurgents, if there is any hope that the war with the Taliban will come to a close. And Biddle says it's in America's interest that as many of these soldiers as possible come from the Afghan public.
It's a lot cheaper to field one Afghan soldier than to field one U.S. Marine or one U.S. Army infantryman. It's more popular in the United States because it means fewer Americans at risk of getting killed. And it may prove to be more effective in as much as the Afghan forces you're building up speak the local language, they're part of the local culture, their ability to interact with the civilians they're operating among is probably better in many cases than ours.
Afghans have their own incentives to go to recruitment depots.
Good work is hard to find in Afghanistan, and the security forces are reliably paid, pretty reliably fed, pretty reliably housed. Those are important incentives to join up. I would not discount the role that the desire to defeat the Taliban plays in recruitment. The Taliban are a notably unpopular organization in Afghanistan. Afghans have been repeatedly polled, and in no poll of which I am aware has the Taliban ever rated above 15% acceptability in the population as a whole.
That being said, there is plenty of controversy over just how big the ANA should grow to be. At any given time, it's hard to pinpoint the exact number of soldiers, given the flux of recruits, desertions, and casualties. But Biddle puts it around 200 to 250,000. And the target number keeps rising.
There has been a proposal to increase the target for the size of the Afghan security forces, the police plus the army, to 400,000. That has not been agreed upon yet. Because it's proven controversial in part because the Pakistanis are nervous about the idea of a 400,000-person security force on their western border that they don't control, and in part because there's skepticism in some significant parts of the West about whether a 400,000-person security force is sustainable financially.
Gatling says the one big problem is that those Afghan troops that do exist really can't operate alone like their American counterparts.
Even though they've graduated, they still need a lot of coaching and mentoring. And it usually takes maybe about a good 2 or 3 years for them to work and train and fight as a unit.
Biddle argues the complete self-sufficiency isn't a feasible goal anyway.
If that's what we insist on doing, if we're planning to hand off an ongoing war to a new military institution, I think the odds are very strong that we'll lose and that we'll hand off a defeat in the making. I think the right way to look at this is we are going to build up an indigenous Afghan partner together with that larger, more capable indigenous Afghan military. We are going to drive the war to a settlement that we can live with. And once the war is settled and the shooting has stopped, then we go home and the Afghan military significantly demobilizes back to a smaller size that they, with Western aid, can sustain for the long term.
Whatever the plan, it must be executed in time for complete withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2014. Well, maybe. Statements from the Pentagon and the Obama administration keep wavering over whether the deadline is set in stone or just a goal. For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
This is War News Radio. According to the Afghan Ministry of Higher Education, their university system still struggles with chronic shortages of funds, infrastructure, and teachers, and many Afghan students choose to pursue degrees abroad. From 2006 to 2010, Rahala Kalapawak attended Swarthmore College, War News Radio's parent organization. Colin Smith recently interviewed him on his experiences.
Could you just tell us who you are?
My name is Ruhullah. I'm from Afghanistan. I finished my high school studies here in Afghanistan, but had the opportunity to come to the United States in 2006. Swarthmore generously awarded me scholarship, full scholarship. Studied there for 4 years. I majored in Middle Eastern studies and returned back to Afghanistan right after my graduation with Swarthmore.
Why did you come to the U.S.?
You know, American colleges are known throughout the world to have the best, you know, teaching and education system. My whole aim, you know, while at Swarthmore and studying at Swarthmore was to return back to Afghanistan and work in the government or in other institutions so I can contribute directly to the Afghan people.
How did you get the opportunity to study in the United States?
When I finished my high school in 2001, Afghanistan was invaded by the U.S. As soon as the Taliban left the country in 2001, I joined media organization or journalists who came to Afghanistan to cover the war. I started with Time magazine first, you know, working there with fixer, translator, and a guide. After that, I was hired by the New York Times. So I worked until 2006 before I leave for America with the New York Times. Basically, I was here in Afghanistan working for the New York Times, and I saw the opportunity that New York Times is also an American newspaper. It will be more possible to go to America than any other country because most of the journalists are Americans. And so I tried, and they convinced me to apply to different colleges. So I applied to probably, I think, 5 or 6 colleges throughout the East Coast of the United States. Swarthmore was very generous, and they awarded me a full scholarship.
What was Swarthmore College like?
It was very tough, but also at the same time, a lot of fun. I had good friends and very good time in the 4 years I was there. Though in the beginning, it was very difficult for me. I had to adjust to, you know, the culture as well as adjust to the educational system. But Swarthmore was very helpful. A lot of my professors, they gave me a lot of their time to explain things and help me out to adjust to the system.
How are you perceived as an Afghan here in America?
Yeah, I was worried about this. I used to hear, you know, some people were saying in America you would be treated differently. And I used to hear a lot of this before I leave for America in 2006. But it was completely different, you know. Swarthmore, the people, the educated people, they were very, very nice and actually very interested to talk to me, which I was surprised, you know, what I was hearing before, but what I was seeing at the time when I was there. People were very, very nice and very friendly to me. I never, in the whole 4 years, I never had any problems or I felt like I was looked upon different there. But I was treated very well.
So how is an American education valued by Afghans?
Definitely. If you speak English, that's the most preferred, you know, person, you know, to be hired by anyone. The countries that are involved in Afghanistan, their main language is English. But if you have a degree from the United States, you would be able to get a good job pretty fast.
As an Afghan who has seen America, what are your thoughts on the American occupation of your country?
Well, I think, you know, Afghanistan is different than the Middle East. You know, a lot of Middle Eastern countries, they have their own resources to gain and stand on their own feet. Afghanistan would very much destroy infrastructure. And our economy is very, very low compared to a lot of others. And I think there is a need for America to remain here and help the Afghan people to stand on their own feet and stabilize their country. We know everything, you know, September 11th, it happened from here. And Americans in America have committed to bring stability and peace to this country. So we'll see.
Rahul currently lives in Kandahar, Afghanistan, and continues to work at the Afghan news desk of the New York Times. For War News Radio, with Alan Zhao, I'm Colin Smith.
This is War News Radio. This past fall, the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at Oxford released a report by Richard Sambrook, the former director of global news for the BBC, which asks, are foreign correspondents redundant? The study concludes that digital technology and economic pressures are rapidly changing the way international news is being reported and consumed. Kyle Crawford has more.
In the 1980s, the major American TV networks maintained about 15 foreign news bureaus. Now, there are fewer than six. Networks have shut down their foreign desks in Moscow, Paris, Tokyo, and Cairo, to name a few. In fact, today there are no network bureaus in India, South America, or Africa, except for a one-man bureau in Kenya. The study is based on Sambrook's experience with the BBC and interviews with a variety of newsmakers and news organizations. He starts by outlining the role that foreign correspondents have played for the last 100 years, and he writes, "We are now entering a new era, where they may no longer be central to how we learn about the world." The study notes a paradox, that even as traditional foreign correspondents become less prevalent, the opportunity to find out about the world is increasing. Andy Mendelson, chair of the Department of Journalism at Temple University, agrees that there has been a drop in the number of foreign correspondents, but he also notes a rising number of local journalists, as Sambrook's study does.
For the last 20 years, 30 years, there's been a huge decline in the numbers of them, American reporters reporting overseas. The fact that there may be increasing numbers of local people, of local reporters doing some of this, may be a good thing, because we've had the amount of foreign news, international coverage, has been declining steadily over the last 20, 30 years.
Mendelson explains that local journalists can bring important context, both cultural and historical, to their reporting, but that there are also issues we have to be aware of.
I mean, I think that they can be just as good reporters as an American dropping in or living there. There's obligations and that they may feel different from different reporting concerns than an American reporter, which is good and bad. I mean, they may report things in different ways than an American reporter, and that may be a good thing. But it may also limit the story if they're protecting what they think of as their culture or something like that. So that's always an issue whenever you have an insider versus an outsider reporting on a place. But potentially, I think that those additional voices, used correctly, used properly, could be a very good thing for people.
Sambrook spoke to many journalists who note how easy it is to self-publish and share stories online with the advent of new communication technologies. However, with this increased competition and freely available news, networks are having to cut costs and cut their foreign correspondents. The study notes that social media is now leading, supplementing, and complementing what professional news organizations offer, providing fresh source material, and competing with traditional news for the public attention. In January 2010, some of the first reports of the earthquake in Haiti came through Twitter. Sambrook notes that the public looked to Twitter over traditional media to discuss and rally around the victims of the disaster. Mendelson also says that Twitter is a valuable tool, but that it doesn't help people grasp the context or the history of an event.
I mean, information is not knowledge, and I would even say it's not necessarily information, it's data. And data needs to be sorted and processed to make it useful to people. And a stream of just tweets is not necessarily helping most people understand a larger context.
He agrees with Sambrook that the way the news is being reported is changing, and he wants the public to realize that moving away from the model of traditional foreign correspondence is not a bad thing.
I just don't think we can keep romanticizing this idea that we need to have American foreign correspondents, that we're the only experts on a place other than our country, you know, in other countries. And I think that's the important thing, is there are experts and perspectives that we can learn a lot from without having them be American citizens.
To answer the question, are foreign correspondents redundant? Sambrook says no. It's true the way international news is reported is changing, but the central mission of correspondence is not. Foreign correspondents will continue to be crucial in bearing witness to international events. For War News Radio, I'm Kyle Crawford.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio in between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Kate Aronoff, Eliana Biscard Church, Emily Ryan, Anjali Kadambi, Sam Hirschman, Rob Halauka, Rosanna Kim, John McMinn, Jared Nolan, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Jillian Ma.
And I'm Louis Katz. Until next time, thanks for listening.